This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Monday, December the 22nd, 2025. We're going to start in the World section and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, to get us started from today's World section, our first headline reads, English voters scatter from the center, strengthening extremes. England appears to be on the edge of a shift away from its traditional Labour-Conservative axis to more radical parties such as Reform UK and the Greens. This particular article is dated December the 21st, and it is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at the Monitor. And the dateline is Bristol and Weston, Supermare, England. For George Brown, election days always came with at least one bit of certainty. He would vote Labour. His family voted Labour, and along this working-class stretch of North Street in Bristol, where kebab shops jostle with tattoo parlors and Chinese takeouts, pretty much everyone else voted Labour, too. Not anymore. Mr. Brown has lost his faith, not only in Labour, but the whole political system. New taxes are hitting the taxi company he works for, which he expects will be passed on to him to protect the company's profits. Meanwhile, the nation's beloved health care system is so broken, he has given up trying to get an appointment for anything that is not life-threatening. Everything, he says, is getting more expensive and worse. It seems like the harder you work, you still don't get ahead, he says as he waits for his next customer. When it comes to politics, he says, I really don't trust any of them anymore. Britain is perched on the precipice of historic political upheaval. Half of Britons want radical change, according to a November poll by Ipsos. In its Shattered Britain study, opinion research firm More in Common says many British voters have reached a roll-the-dice moment. For a nation where the traditional political order, dominated by the Conservatives and Labour, has had the constancy of the Cliffs of Dover, everything appears chaotically uncertain. For now, the Labour government retains a large majority in Parliament thanks to its 2024 landslide election victory. But the speed of the party's collapse in the polls is unprecedented, political scientists say. Its support among voters now sits at 18%, Ipsos finds. The biggest winner so far has been the far-right Reform UK party, which is polling at 33%. But the story of England's political transformation goes deeper. For the first time ever, five parties are polling at over 10%, with a sixth trying to elbow its way in. It speaks to a crumbling of the old order as voting blocks that have held firm for generations fracture into new configurations, desperately seeking change. England's West Country offers an intriguing portrait. From the fervid radicalism of left-wing Bristol to the seaside town of Weston-super-Mare, which has seen the summers of its prosperity fade into decline and neglect. How are they coping and to whom they are turning for answers speaks to a new country now starting to emerge. What is new is that some people are now willing to take risks, says Ed Hodgson, Deputy Director of Research for More in Common. The situation in Britain is so miserable that people are very fed up. The picture is broadly similar across the United Kingdom, but England's political dynamics are distinct from those of the UK's other nations due to its lack of separatist parties such as Plaid Cymru in Wales and the Scottish National Party. Moreover, the rise of English nationalism points to a uniquely English element of these political trends. Similarly, Britain's challenges are similar to those seen across Europe, a stagnant economy, rising stress on social issues, and growing public debt. But Britain has a unique added variable. Brexit, which took effect just as the COVID-19 pandemic was beginning to wreak havoc on the world economy. Combine that with a puzzling and persisting drop in worker productivity, and the country has never recovered. Previous Conservative governments responded with cuts and austerity. The 2024 election was a more was more a resounding rejection of that path than a true win for labor, political experts argue. Now, labor is largely treading water, hoping for economic growth, which hasn't come, and adopting tough anti-immigrant policies to try to attract centrist voters. But that appears to be part of the problem. Is labor trying to win over voters who are disappearing? At the For All Healthy Living Center in Weston-super-Mare, Shane O'Connell and Mandy Townsend are arguing, again, no one else in the community center's cafe is in the least concerned. This is what they do, two friends sitting over a cup of tea, disagreeing and sometimes agreeing with great affection. Politics is a hot topic. The conversation wanders in enthusiastic bursts from theories about propaganda campaigns to keep voters under control to the potential effects of the video game Grand Theft Auto on local youth. The two are from different political spheres. Ms. Townsend says politicians should give 5% of their salaries to help those less fortunate, something she says she would gladly do too. People shouldn't open the fridge and have no food, she says. Mr. O'Connell wants a leader with backbone. We've only had one good leader in this country, conservative icon Margaret Thatcher. She was powerful. You make a decision, you stick to it. Though mutual fondness bridges the gap between these two friends, their politics are moving in opposite directions. Ms. Townsend is considering shifting further to the left, saying she likes what she hears from the Green Party. If they can keep what they're saying, that wouldn't be so bad. Mr. O'Connell pauses before sharing his political preference. If he had help, Nigel Farage. Ms. Townsend groans. Mr. Farage is the leader of Reform UK, and while his party is top of the polls, he also generates the highest unfavorability ratings outside the two main parties. Mr. O'Connell is undeterred, however, expressing support for Mr. Farage's strong anti-immigration platform. He's going about it the wrong way, Mr. O'Connell says. He makes it sound racist, but it's just fair. In important ways, Ms. Townsend and Mr. O'Connell represent a crucial shift in the British electorate. The battle is no longer between right and left, conservatives versus labor. It is right versus right and left versus left, conservatives versus reform and labor versus the Greens, for instance. Research shows that voters have sorted themselves into two distinct ideological blocks and don't shift between them much. Centrist voters are disappearing. Voters are abandoning generations-old alliances based on social class and aligning more according to age and education. This is the new world that Brexit has made, or at least revealed. What happened is that Brexit itself brought to the fore these two different worldviews, said James David Griffiths, a research fellow at the British Election Study. They were long-term trends that Brexit catalyzed. In Weston-super-Mare, signs point toward a shift to reform. The story of Weston-super-Mare is the story of England's embattled seaside towns. For generations, they were England's communal watering holes, charming coastal getaways where working-class families gathered every summer when factories closed for 2 weeks. They became the iconic vacation postcard of beaches and boardwalks, long ocean piers, and kitschy ice cream parlors. Then came cheap vacation packages to Spain, and 2 weeks in the British drizzle began looking less appealing. Weston-super-Mare and its cousins became a part of wistful national memory. On the eastern side of England, another seaside town, Jawick, ranks as the most deprived of the 33,000 areas measured by the British government. It is Mr. Farage's home constituency. For its part, Weston-super-Mare is 86, and Bourneville Estate, the neighborhood surrounding the For All Healthy Living Center, is the most deprived area in the county of Somerset. The red and white cross of the English flag, which has been seeing a resurgence as a symbol of nationalism, hangs from rooftops. Local talk of the growing number of charity stores along the high street downtown. Locals talk of the growing number of charity stores along the high street downtown, fewer and fewer people can afford retail prices. I've seen kids have to go without gas for heating and hot water for weeks because they had to pay for electric, says Amber Williams, a Bourneville resident. That's not normal. To many, it feels like the nation is coming apart at the seams. The key question is whom to blame. James Clayton is a Labor city councilor for Weston-super-Mare, though on this day he is dressed in the neon vest of a community warden. His knuckles are tattooed, his hands the oaken tools of the boxer he still is, now as a coach. His craft taught him the lesson he still lives by in tough times. Bite hard on my gum shield, and keep fighting. It could be a motto for his town. His task as a warden is to police the streets to protect local businesses. These days, he is much less certain how to protect his own party. He is hearing one thing repeatedly from many of his constituents. I've never voted before, but I'm registering to vote for Farage. The reason is always the same. We've had enough of the boats. The boats are crossing the channel from France, carrying clandestine migrants, and Mr. Farage has made them the centerpiece of his explanation for why England has fallen on such hard times. His argument has struck a chord, though many migration experts dispute his conclusions. From Weston-super-Mare to Bristol, voters talk about a decline in responsibility. At the For All Healthy Living Center, Ms. Townsend says people are collecting disability allowances despite not really being disabled. On North Street in Bristol, Mr. Brown, the cab driver, talks of someone living in his complex who is receiving state benefits that have paid his rent for 6 months and paid for a new Volkswagen Golf. What's the point of working, he asks. I work 6 days a week, and he's getting the same as my PlayStation. As me to play PlayStation. Sorry, there we go. The comments aren't aimed at against any specific people or even the values of the benefits themselves, which most acknowledge. Rather, they point to a growing sense that not everyone is doing their fair share. This is often more acutely directed at migrants, who many see as coming to take advantage of Britain's benefits. Studies show the reality is more complex, with migrant flows influenced by various factors. But the boats are simple answers for many trying to understand what has gone wrong. Part of it is the deluge of information. People don't know what to believe, says Gavin Esler, an author and former BBC political analyst. They're looking for a leader who can cut through that. Boats are the one thing you can point to that cuts through. The lesson of cutting through the noise with simple messages appears to be working in a different way on the left, too. Not far from North Street in Bristol's Dame Emily Park, Mirit Ben Yitzchak sits on a bench with a friend enjoying a spell of December sunshine. They identify themselves as longtime Labor supporters, but recently the party's every step is in the wrong direction, the friend who identifies himself only as Tal says. The one person who is talking sense, says Ms. Ben Yitzchak, is Green Party leader Zach Polanski. I really like what he stands for. What Mr. Farage is to the right, Mr. Polanski seeks to be for the left. And if Mr. Farage is pointing to the boats, then Mr. Polanski is pointing to the rich, saying they are not paying their fair share. Instead of reaching out for centrists, he is attempting to out-labor Labor and make the Greens the new standard-bearer for the British left. In Bristol, at least, it appears to be working. That shouldn't be too surprising. Bristol is a city of paradoxes. It is a city that built its wealth trading slaves and tobacco, and the scions of the families enriched by that business still enjoy considerable influence through the Charitable Society of Merchant Venturers, which traces its roots to the 13th century. But it is also the city of Banksy, the anonymous street artist whose subversive graffiti has become a worldwide phenomenon. In the word of one local journalist, Bristol likes a good riot. At the height of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, protesters in Bristol pulled down a statue of Edward Colston, one of the city's favorite sons and a slave trader, defaced it and rolled it into the harbor. A Bristol neighborhood once rioted to protest the opening of a Tesco chain grocery store. The desire for change is no less potent here than in Weston-super-Mare, though Palestinian flags flutter above the city, not the English St. George's Cross. One of the ceremonial names for the square in front of City Hall is Hannah Arendt Platz, honoring the German philosopher famous for her writings against authoritarianism. The Greens are now the largest party in city government, and in October they added one more councillor to their ranks. Al-Maghrabi has been with Labour, now he is a Green. Born in East London, he came to Bristol for university and never left, a portrait of Bristol's increasing profile as a university town. Britain's Berkeley. Along the way, he also became a portrait of the city's greenward turn. As soon as Labour Prime Minister Keir Starmer got into office, Mr. Maghrabi said, "It seems like he just acted as though he was pro-reform." The people who are causing problems in our country, it's not the immigrants, it's those on top, he adds. It is a message that plays well here. Harry Simpson is a university student and a member of the Young Greens in Bristol, and the moments that pushed him into politics are indelible. Hearing Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg at a rally in Bristol, seeing his mom crying in front of the television the morning Brexit passed. That morning, he says, "I realized the role of politicians and how they are leading people." He can feel the change. For a lot of people, voting Labour is a familial thing, and breaking that is very emotional, he says. But what people want from politics today is different, and Britain's traditional parties have been slow to learn that lesson, he suggests. Politics is becoming a lot more emotional. People are not connected with the managerialist aspect. Conservatives and Labour are just talking about managing the status quo differently. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Moving on to the second headline from today's World section of The Monitor, it reads, "Russia strikes Ukrainian port as peace negotiations continue in U.S. The airstrikes on port infrastructure in Odessa come as the Kremlin sends an envoy to Florida to discuss the Trump administration's proposed peace plan. Meanwhile, European Union leaders agreed to provide $106 billion to support Ukraine's military and economic needs over the next 2 years. The date on this article is December the 20th, 2025, and it is by the Associated Press. The dateline is Kyiv, Ukraine. A Russian missile strike on port infrastructure in Odessa in southern Ukraine killed 8 people and wounded 27. Ukraine's emergency service said Saturday, as a Kremlin envoy was set to travel to Florida for talks on a U.S. proposed plan to end the nearly 4-year war. The discussions are part of the Trump administration's months-long push for peace that also included meetings with Ukrainian and European officials in Berlin earlier this week. Ukraine's chief negotiator said late Friday that his delegation had completed separate meetings with the U.S., in the U.S. with American and European partners. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said much will depend on the U.S. posture after discussions with the Russian. Speaking at a news conference in Kyiv with Portuguese Prime Minister Luis Montenegro, Mr. Zelensky said that, quote, "the key question remains how the United States responds after consultations with the Russians. At this point, I honestly don't know, but I will know later today." End quote. Hours later, answering journalists' questions via a WhatsApp chat, Mr. Zelensky said the Trump administration had floated a trilateral meeting in Miami involving the U.S., Ukraine, and Russia. But he said thorny issues remained. The most difficult issues were and remain Ukraine's territories. Next is the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The third issue is funding for reconstruction. There are also several technical questions regarding security guarantees, monitoring formats, and so on, he said. The nuclear plant, the largest in Europe, has been under Russian occupation since the early days of the war and has repeatedly lost power supply as a result of the fighting, sparking safety fears. Ukraine and Portugal signed an agreement to establish joint production of maritime drones. Mr. Zelensky said at the news conference with Portuguese PM Montenegro, "This is one of the most promising areas of defense cooperation. What matters now is delivering results, and all parts of Europe must have sufficient capabilities to counter any threats," he said. Some of those wounded in Odessa were on a bus at the center of the strike late Friday, the emergency service said in a telegram post. Trucks caught fire in the parking lot, and cars were also damaged. "The port was struck with ballistic missiles," says Ole Kipper, the head of the Odessa region. Moscow did not immediately acknowledge reports of the attack. The Russian Defense Ministry said Saturday that over the previous day it had struck unspecified transport and storage infrastructure used by the Ukrainian armed forces, along with energy facilities and those supplying Kyiv's war efforts. Elsewhere, Ukrainian drones hit a Russian oil rig, the military patrol ship Okhotnik, and other facilities. Ukraine's general staff said in a statement Saturday. It said the ship was patrolling in the Caspian Sea near an oil and gas production platform. The extent of the damage was still being clarified, it said. The drilling platform at Filinovsky oil and gas field was also hit. The facility is operated by Russian oil giant Lukoil. Ukrainian drones also struck a radar system in the Krasnosilsky area of Crimea, which Russia illegally annexed from Ukraine in 2014. There was no immediate comment from the Russian government or Lukoil. The company is one of two Russian oil majors alongside state-owned Gazprom, targeted by recent U.S. sanctions that aim to deprive Moscow of oil export revenue that helps it sustain the war. Kyiv has used similar arguments to justify months of long-range strikes on Russian oil infrastructure, which it says both funds and directly fuels the Kremlin's all-out invasion, soon to enter its fifth year. U.S. President Donald Trump has unleashed an extensive diplomatic push to end the war, but his efforts have run into sharply conflicting demands by Moscow and Kyiv. Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently signaled he is digging in on his maximalist demands on Ukraine as Moscow's troops inch forward on the battlefield despite huge losses. On Friday, Mr. Putin voiced confidence that the Kremlin would achieve its goals militarily if Kyiv doesn't agree to Russia's conditions in peace talks. European Union leaders on Friday agreed to provide 90 billion euros, or $106 billion, to Ukraine to meet its military and economic needs for the next 2 years, although they failed to bridge differences with Belgium that would allow them to use frozen Russian assets to raise the funds. Instead, they were borrowed on capital markets. For almost 4 years of war, the International Monetary Fund estimates that Ukraine will need 137 billion euros, or $161 billion, in 2026 and 2027. The government in Kyiv is on the verge of bankruptcy and desperately needs the money by spring. Meanwhile, Kirill Dmitriev, who heads Russia's sovereign wealth fund, is set to meet with Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner in Miami on Saturday, according to a U.S. official. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to preview a meeting that hasn't yet been publicly announced. The official said Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner will sit down with Mr. Dmitriev after meetings with Ukrainian and European officials in Berlin for talks on U.S. security guarantees for Kyiv, territorial concessions, and other aspects of the American-authored plan. Ukraine's chief negotiator, Rustem Umerov, said late Friday that a Ukrainian delegation had met with American and European partners in the U.S. He gave few details but said they agreed to continue joint work in the near future. Asked about the meeting in Miami, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Thursday that Moscow was preparing for contacts with the U.S. to learn about the results of the meetings in Berlin, but he didn't give details. And a note here, this story was reported by the Associated Press, AP writers Matthew Lee in Washington and Ilya Novikov in Kyiv, Ukraine, contributed to the report, which, of course, was an Associated Press article. Still from the World section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Why Latin America's Authoritarian Leaders Lean Into Christmas. Christmas came early this year in Venezuela at leader Nicolas Maduro's behest. It's the same tactic Hugo Chavez used as far back as 2003. The date on this article is December the 19th. It is by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and me, Hojris Dahl, who is a special contributor at the Monitor. The dateline is Mexico City and Bogota, Colombia. Christmas is fast approaching, but in Venezuela, the holidays have been underway for nearly 3 months already, whether citizens like it or not. Just days after the first U.S. military strike on a boat allegedly carrying drugs in the Caribbean, leader Nicolas Maduro announced that Christmas was going to arrive early this year for the economy, for culture, for joy and happiness. Starting October 1st, Christmas begins in Venezuela, Mr. Maduro said on September 8th in his nationally broadcast television program, Con Maduro. So, on a hot and humid Wednesday in October, out came the Santa hats, the sparkling streetlights, and the bouncy Christmas tunes. It's not the first time a drawn-out Christmas has been used to distract the population from political and economic woes. Last year, Mr. Maduro officially called for Christmas to come early, following weeks of civil unrest over a presidential election which he claimed without proof to have won. His predecessor, Hugo Chavez, declared Christmas in October in 2003, when the country was still recovering from a general strike. Starting in 2007 and lasting nearly a decade, President Daniel Ortega's government had the Nicaraguan capital of Managua roundabouts decorated with dazzling Christmas trees for all 12 months of the year. This year, El Salvador's Nayib Bukele passed a law requiring Christmas bonuses to be paid out by the end of October. What these leaders have in common is their authoritarian style of governing. And although decreeing Christmas joy is not part of any traditional authoritarian playbook, it does achieve certain goals that might bolster a leader's standing, like offering a distraction from a difficult reality or boosting economic activity. You could say in the U.S. we've moved the holiday season earlier and earlier, too, but that is clearly about consumerism. Whereas this is very political, says Rebecca Bill Chavez, president and CEO of the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank in Washington. They're trying to project festivity, but that doesn't match reality. Christmas has long been a cherished time of year in Venezuela. Seasonal specialties like Jalacas, a tamale-like dish stuffed with raisins, capers, olives, and meat, are prepared. Gaita, folk music, is played, and carols are sung. Metro stations are decked out with nativity scenes. Tree trunks are wrapped in lights with brilliant stars dripping off the branches in public plazas. And government buildings are transformed into canvases for nightly light shows. Although the early celebrations bothered one government worker, he acknowledges that at night the city looks more striking, more cheerful, he says. Like all Venezuelans interviewed for this story, he asked for anonymity to protect his safety. In the end, people become wrapped up in that sense of magic, he said. Despite Mr. Maduro's calling early a Christmas decree, there are no written guidelines about what is expected or required of the population. One man in Caracas mentioned that the only apartment in his building with its balcony decked out in shimmering lights belongs to a member of the military. At a moment when neighbors are being encouraged to spy on one another and report government dissent through a mobile phone app, fears of fines or looking disloyal aren't unfounded. Everything government officials have declared has been verbal, says a human rights defender in Caracas. In other words, officials from CINEAT, the tax authority, or the municipality can tell merchants they have to put up decorations, and if they don't, they will inspect them and sanction them for tax-related noncompliance, and there's little a civilian can do to push back. The government employee says he was required to purchase holiday T-shirts with $10 of his own money, a high price in Venezuela. In Venezuela's moribund economy, and for the first 2 weeks of October, had to dedicate the last hour of each workday to office dance parties with live Christmas music. Everyone in the public sector mobilizes and complies because they fear their jobs are on the line, he says. Kurt Wayland, a political science professor at the University of Texas at Austin, puts the early Christmas moves in the same category as dictators in Brazil and Argentina using big soccer wins to project images of strength and development in the 1970s. These are distractions, Dr. Whalen said. It's less about bringing joy and more about control. Experts say Mr. Maduro's Christmas decree is meant to distract Venezuelans from U.S. military threats, one of the worst economic contractions in the world, and a daily struggle to put food on the table. He may also be hoping to boost consumption in a faltering economy, but few Venezuelans have the means to consume more. Venezuela's gross domestic product contracted by more than 80% between 2013 and 2020, and inflation is extremely high, eroding wages and purchasing power. Early Christmas might be more effective as an authoritarian tool if it included government handouts like much-needed food or medical supplies, says Dr. Chavez, who studies democracy and authoritarianism. The central toolbox of authoritarianism has been perfected over time and includes things like changing the Constitution to allow for re-election or playing with term limits, controlling Congress, stifling the media, and taking away the independence of the judiciary. Christmas alone as a tool is unlikely to work, she says. Venezuelans are very aware that there is a conflict brewing between Mr. Maduro and U.S. President Donald Trump, and says a Caracas-based photographer. It's also necessary to try to carry on their lives as normally as possible, he says. We celebrate, we have fun, and we wait for things to pass, he says. It's the Viva la Pepe attitude, a Venezuelan expression akin to whatever happens, happens. And once again, this particular article was by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and me, Hodris Dahl, who is a special contributor at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor. And our first headline reads, What Comes After Trump? Turning Point USA endorses Vance amid party discord. Erica Kirk, leader of the conservative youth organization Turning Point USA, endorsed Vice President J.D. Vance as the Republican nominee for the 2028 presidential election during the group's annual America Fest convention. Talk of future campaigns is complicated by President Donald Trump's occasional musing about seeking a third term. The date on this article is December the 21st, and it is by Jonathan J. Cooper and Sejal Govindaro of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Phoenix, Arizona. The next presidential election is 3 years away, but Turning Point USA already knows it wants Vice President J.D. Vance as the Republican nominee. Erica Kirk, leader of the powerful conservative youth organization, endorsed him on opening night of its annual America Fest convention, drawing cheers from the crowd. But the four-day gathering revealed more peril than promise for Mr. Vance or any other potential successor to President Donald Trump, and the tensions on display foreshadow the treacherous waters that they will need to navigate in the coming years. The Make America Great Again movement is fracturing as Republicans begin considering a future without President Donald Trump, and there is no clear path to holding his coalition together as different factions jockey for influence. After a weekend of debates about whether the movement should include figures such as anti-Semitic podcaster Nick Fuentes, Mr. Vance came down on the side of open debate. I don't bring a list of conservatives to denounce or deplatform, Mr. Vance said Sunday during the convention's closing speech. He decried self-defeating purity tests and said there was a place for you in the movement if you love America. We don't care if you're white or black, rich or poor, young or old, rural or urban, controversial or a little bit boring, or somewhat in between, Mr. Vance said. He did not name Mr. Fuentes, but his comment came in the midst of an increasingly contentious debate over whether the MAGA movement should include Mr. Fuentes and his followers. The Republican Party's identity has been intertwined with Mr. Trump for a decade. Now that he is constitutionally ineligible to run for re-election, the party is starting to ponder a future without him at the helm. So far, it looks like settling that question will require a lot of fighting among conservatives. Turning Point featured arguments about anti-Semitism, Israel, and environmental regulations, not to mention rivalries between leading commentators. Who gets to run it after, asked commentator Tucker Carlson, summing up the core fight in his speech at the conference. Who gets the machinery when the president exits the scene? Mr. Carlson said the idea of a Republican civil war was totally fake. There are people who are mad at J.D. Vance, and they're stirring up a lot of this in order to make sure he doesn't get the nomination, he said. Carlson described Mr. Vance as the one person who subscribes to the core idea of the Trump coalition, which Mr. Carlson said was America first. Turning Point spokesperson Andrew Colvett framed the discord as a healthy debate about the future of the movement, as an uncomfortable but necessary process of finding consensus. We're not hive-minded commies, he wrote on X. Let it play out. Erica Kirk, who took over as Turning Point's leader when her husband Charlie Kirk was assassinated, said Thursday that the group wanted Mr. Vance elected for 48 in the most resounding way possible. The next president will be the 48th in U.S. history. Turning Point is a major force on the right with a nationwide volunteer network that can be especially helpful in early primary states when candidates rely on grassroots energy to build momentum. In a surprise appearance, rapper Nicki Minaj spoke effusively about Mr. Trump and Mr. Vance. Ms. Kirk's endorsement carried at least a little bit of weight for Kiara Wagner, who traveled from Toms River, New Jersey, for the conference. If someone like Erica could support J.D. Vance, then I can too, said Ms. Wagner. Mr. Vance was close with Charlie Kirk. After Mr. Kirk's assassination on a college campus in Utah, the vice president flew out on Air Force Two to collect Mr. Kirk's remains and bring them home to Arizona. The vice president helped uniformed service members carry the casket to the plane. I'm honored to be on Turning Point's team, Mr. Vance said. Not everyone in the GOP stands with Vance. Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, says Mr. Vance represents a turn away from the limited government, pro-trade, low-tax orthodoxy that has defined the Republican Party for generations. The GOP should stick with its roots, he said, and that is not Mr. Vance. All these pro-tariff protectionists, they love taxes, and so they tax, 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 and then they brag about all the revenue coming in, Mr. Paul said on ABC's This Week. That has never been a conservative position. Mr. Vance appears to have the edge on the 2028 nomination as far as Turning Point attendees are concerned. It has to be J.D. Vance because he has been so awesome when it comes to literally any question, says Thomas Morales, a videographer from Los Angeles. He said there's no other choice. Mr. Trump has not chosen a successor, though he has spoken highly of both Mr. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, even suggesting they could form a future Republican ticket. Mr. Rubio has said he would support Mr. Vance. Asked in August whether Mr. Vance was the heir apparent, Mr. Trump said, most likely. It's too early, obviously, to talk about it, but certainly he's doing a great job and he would be probably favored at this point, he said. Any talk of future campaigns is complicated by Mr. Trump's occasional musings about seeking a third term. I'm not allowed to run, he told reporters during a trip to Asia in October. It's too bad. The president's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., is close to Mr. Vance and advocated for him to get the vice presidential nomination in 2024. Mr. Trump Jr. echoed Mr. Vance's vision for the United States to take a step back from its role ensuring global security, and said immigration is negatively changing the nation's identity. A country cannot survive when it imports people who don't share their values, Mr. Trump Jr. said. We don't owe the world a thing. We owe Americans their American dream. And again, this particular story was reported by the Associated Press and written by Onathan J. Cooper and Sajal Govindarao of the Associated Press. Continuing on from the USA section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, How the Lumbee Tribe Earned Federal Recognition After a Decades-Long Effort. The Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, with more than 55,000 members, earned federal recognition from Congress after decades of attempts. The status will open more government benefits for tribal members and fulfills a campaign promise by President Donald Trump. The date on this article is December the 20th. It is by Patrick Johnson, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Even through the din of his North Carolina fish market, Joseph Jones' excitement is palpable. On December 17th, Congress recognized his people, the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, as a full-fledged American tribe eligible for government benefits, health care assistance, and potentially a casino. It's been a long time, but we finally made it, man, Mr. Jones, whose family owns the Lumbee Fish Market in Pembroke, North Carolina, said in a phone interview. People steady working, steady pushing it, steady going to the White House, steady letting Congress know we are Native, regardless of what people say about us, and we are proud to be Native American. Donald Trump, who had long professed his love for the Lumbee people, signed the National Defense Authorization Act on December 18th. Tucked into the defense funding bill was the Lumbee Fairness Act, making the Lumbee the 575th recognized tribe in the United States. The tribe instantly became one of the nation's largest. It took the Lumbee more than 30 attempts to earn federal recognition, as its members have fought allegations from other tribes that they have not proved their historical lineage and continuous government. The recognition is in part a testament to the Lumbee tribe's growing political power, with more than 55,000 members. It highlights how the Lumbee have become an influential voting bloc in North Carolina and quietly exerted influence on the national stage. The pushback their recognition has stirred from other Native American tribes also brings into focus how questions of identity linger as the Lumbee tribe looks to build upon its new federal recognition. It's really a fascinating window into this moment. Here is a kind of racial justice victory under a presidency that has attacked the social justice movement on many fronts, says Julian Brave Nosecat, a writer and filmmaker and member of the Canem Lake Band Tsequessen in California. The tribe has been an interesting political chameleon as its identity has always been Native but also transforming over time. The Lumbee call themselves the people of the dark water. Though there are outposts of Lumbee in Baltimore and Philadelphia, most today live in around the Lumber River in Robeson County, North Carolina, where tribal connections are cemented and understood by the question, where do you church? The Lumbee's founding story, according to some historians and tribal leaders, intermingles with the European-American one. In one theory, the Lumbee emerged after Europeans possibly left the lost colony of Roanoke in modern-day North Carolina in the late 16th century to live with local Native Americans on Croatan Island. The Lumbee tribe website says some ancestors of the tribe have always lived on the Lumbee River, while others migrated from parts of the Carolinas and Virginia. Lumbee is the name the tribe chose for itself in the 1950s. A team that included a Harvard University professor traveled to Robeson County in 1934 to assess the tribe's eligibility for recognition. They found that though the tribe was doubtlessly indigenous, it didn't meet the federal definition, which at the time considered only race, not culture, ancestors, or relatives. Often, Lumbee don't look uniquely Indian, including some who have freckles and red hair. Many share Tuscarora eyes, a gray shade traced by many to early colonial settlers. Tribal leaders and members say it is a testimony to the inclusiveness of the tribe, which weighs familial bonds more than bloodline percentages. The historic struggle for legitimacy makes the Lumbee federal recognition fight partly about who does and doesn't count as Native, supporters of the Lumbee tribe say. The Lumbees are a rich example of how to exercise self-determination against the strongest possible opposition, America's insistence on their invisibility, writes Emory University historian and Lumbee tribe member Melinda Mayer Lowry in the Lumbee Indians and American Struggle. North Carolina has recognized the tribe since the 1880s, but Congress, which oversees federal recognition, has consistently turned down the Lumbees until now. The Lumbee have watched as 23 other tribes have gained recognition since the 1970s. The latest was the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Montana, which were recognized through the Defense Authorization Bill in 2019. In some ways, the Lumbee tribe's struggles for recognition might have less to do with proving their historical heritage than with pocketbook issues. Stalwart opposition has come from the 15,000-strong eastern band of the Cherokee Nation. The Lumbee would be the first to receive recognition without demonstrating any descent from a historical tribe, Michelle Hicks, the chief of the eastern band of Cherokee, told Congress in November. Native American tribes can earn federal recognition through several pathways, including by act of Congress, through a federal court decision, and by recognition from the Office of Federal Acknowledgement within the Department of Interior. That office evaluates petitions based on anthropological, genealogical, and historical research methods. In a statement, Mr. Hicks criticized the Lumbee tribe for seeking recognition through Congress instead of the merit-based federal acknowledgement program. Doing so without a verified history, language, traditions, land-based, and treaty rights sets a dangerous precedent for regulation moving forward and undermines the standards that protect tribal nations and federal Indian law, he wrote. At the same time, the award-winning drum circle group, Warpaint, has Lumbee members and regularly conducts powwows with the Eastern Band. That cultural acceptance to some suggests that opposition may also be about gambling markets. The Eastern Band of Cherokee tribe runs a casino in Cherokee, North Carolina, across the state from Robeson County. The Eastern Band have a history of protecting their gaming market, and this is potentially going to be cutting into that, says Michael Fletcher, a University of Michigan Law School professor and author of The Ghost Road, Anishinaabe Responses to Indian Hating. Another aspect of worry is that the amount of money appropriated by Congress is given in a given year for governmental services is finite. So there's a little bit of a cut that Eastern Band may be expecting, given that the Lumbee will be one of the largest tribes in the country going forward, he adds. In recent years, members of the Lumbees have increasingly voted Republican. President Trump held a rally in Robeson County in October of 2020, during which he promised to support federal recognition of the Lumbee tribe. As candidates in 2024, both Mr. Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris pledged to support recognition of the Lumbee. Robeson County, whose population is just over 40% indigenous, voted for President Barack Obama in two elections before swinging to support Mr. Trump in the past three presidential elections. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, a Republican, first introduced the Lumbee Fairness Act in Congress in 2023. This week, Republicans and Democrats lined up behind the Lumbee Fairness Act's inclusion in the Defense Authorization Bill. Wearing a Native bolo tie on the Senate floor on December 17th, Mr. Tillis later credited the tribe's resilience, service, and dignity as they fought for fair treatment. I thank the Lumbee tribe for never giving up on our nation, and I'm honored that our nation has finally stopped giving up on them, Senator Tillis said in a video message. North Carolina's Democratic Governor, Josh Stein, also supported the new recognition. Most immediately for the Lumbee, the tribe now faces what amounts to a nation-building project as federal subsidies ramp up. They have to build up infrastructure, law enforcement, tribal courts, social services, everything you can imagine, says Professor Fletcher, who also serves as Chief Justice of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians, and the Powatch Band of Creek Indians. It's a great opportunity for them, but they are starting from scratch. Mr. Jones, the fish seller in Pembroke, says his people are up for the challenge, given a long struggle for legitimacy and support in one of the poorest corners of North Carolina. "We're not hunting money, we're hunting for help for our elders," says Mr. Jones. And again, this particular article is by Patrick Johnson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move quickly on to the commentary section of today's Monitor. And the headline for today reads, "For Ukraine and Taiwan, Dissuasion and Strength." The West's big military aid packages for the two democracies will be additional deterrence to aggression by Russia and China, perhaps forcing concessions for peace. The date on this is December the 19th, and it is by the Monitor's editorial board. With calm resolve, the United States and the European Union have each made decisions in recent days showing a firm watchfulness against big power aggression. Neither will receive a Nobel Peace Prize for its actions. Alfred Nobel's idea of a secure world did not include military deterrence. Yet together, the U.S. and EU have at least helped make war a bit more unthinkable. On December 17th, the Trump administration approved the largest ever U.S. arms sale to Taiwan. Congress is expected to approve the $11.1 billion weapons package, especially after the House Select Committee on China issued a report Thursday calling for unambiguous opposition to Beijing's moves towards an invasion of the self-governing democratic island. Earlier this month, President Trump issued a national security strategy that says, quote, "Deterring a conflict over Taiwan, ideally by preserving military overmatch, is a priority," end quote. Last month, Taiwan's government proposed a $40 billion special budget for military spending, part of an effort to boost its defenses. History demonstrates that compromising with aggressors ultimately brings only endless aftermath of war and subjugation, says President Lai Ching-te. On Friday, meanwhile, EU leaders agreed to borrow £90 billion, about $106 billion, to provide critical aid to Ukraine against the Russian military. The money may allow the country to survive into 2027. Ukraine will not need to repay the loan until Russia compensates it with reparations. "The only way to bring Russia to the negotiating table is to strengthen Ukraine," said European Council President Antonio Costa. While the aid amounts was not as much as many EU states wanted, the final figure is a decisive message for an end to the war, says Friedrich Merz, the German chancellor. Overall, Europe has spent more money than the U.S. to help Ukraine during the nearly four-year war. The latest protection for Taiwan and Ukraine, both democracies threatened by autocratic neighbors, is not a fear-based strategy. It is a recognition that showing strength against evil can dissolve its power. As the German leader said, Russian President Vladimir Putin will only make concessions once he realizes his war will not pay off. And again, that is a commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. And we're going to move right over to the economy section of today's Monitor next. And our first headline reads, "What's for dinner? If it's beef, it'll cost you." Eye-popping prices for steaks and burgers are mostly a supply problem, exacerbated by lack of competition in the meatpacking industry. The upshot is that beef is likely to remain expensive for a while. The date on this article is December the 17th, and it is by Simon Motlick, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. If you plan on serving roast beef at a gathering this holiday season, brace for sticker shock at the grocery store. The same goes for steaks and hamburgers as beef prices hit record highs in the United States, rattling President Donald Trump, who has vowed to bring prices down. The average price for ground beef hit $6.30 a pound in September, up from $5.50 at the start of the year, an increase of almost 15%. As recently as May 2023, ground beef retailed for less than $5 a pound. Steak prices have risen even more sharply in recent months, hitting retailers and restaurants alike. Higher beef prices are squeezing margins at restaurant chains that have been reluctant to raise prices. The price of beef has gotten the attention of the White House. Mr. Trump signed an executive order on December 6th to examine anti-competitive behavior in food supply chains, including beef production. The Justice Department has also begun an antitrust investigation into meatpacking companies. Both measures are framed as a response to rising concerns over beef prices. Polling shows that voters are upset about the cost of beef and other everyday items and have soured on Mr. Trump's economic management, even as he claims he has, quote, crushed inflation that spiked under his predecessor, President Joe Biden. They caused the highest prices, and we're bringing them down, he said in a speech in Pennsylvania on December 9th, referring to Democrats. The most recent monthly report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows inflation at 3% above the Federal Reserve's 3% above the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. Some ranchers are complaining about Mr. Trump's trade policies, including his agreement to quadruple beef imports from Argentina and his on-off tariffs on Brazilian beef. The rollback of specific tariffs has been aimed at bringing down consumer prices. The Brazilian tariff relief includes coffee, the price of which was up 41% in September compared with the previous year. But most of the 28 billion pounds of beef consumed annually in the U.S., especially cuts of steak and roast, is domestically produced. Experts say the price of beef depends less on tweaks to the administration's trade policy and more on the lack of competition in the meatpacking industry, which is a much knottier problem to fix and one that has eluded previous administrations. The upshot is that beef prices are likely to stay high for a while. Simply put, it's about a lack of supply. The number of cattle being raised for slaughter in the U.S. has fallen to the lowest level since the 1950s. Ranchers cut their herds during and after the pandemic amid prolonged droughts in the states such as Texas and higher feedstock costs. The total herd of beef cattle was 28.7 million in July, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Beef producers can't respond to higher prices as quickly as consumers may wish, since it takes around 2 years for a newborn calf to reach maturity. I expect prices are going to remain high until we start producing more cows, says James McDonald, a research professor at the University of Maryland's College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. It takes a long time to rebuild herds, he said. The suspension of Mexican cattle imports in May, after an outbreak of screwworm, had further restricted supply. Screwworm, a tropical parasite, was eradicated decades ago in the U.S. Reopening the border to Mexican cattle would boost supply, but would be risky unless the parasite is contained, says Professor McDonald. As U.S. beef production drops, the meatpacking industry has been trying to produce more beef from the cattle it slaughters. By historic standards, we're still producing a lot of beef. We're just doing it with fewer cows, says Glenn Tonsler, a professor of agricultural economics at Kansas State University. So far, demand for beef has largely held up despite the higher prices. Per capita consumption is forecast at 58.5 pounds this year, according to the USDA, slightly down from 2024. Mr. Trump has asked his senior advisors to find more policy levers he can pull to bring beef prices down, the Wall Street Journal reported. He has consulted with trade organizations, governors of farm states, and the meat industry. His executive order directs the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to examine competition in the U.S. food supply. Ranchers, consumer groups, and farm state lawmakers have complained for years about anti-competitive practices in beef processing. Four major processors dominate the industry: Tyson Foods, Cargill, and two Brazilian-based companies, JBS and Marfrig Global Foods. Together, they slaughter around 85% of grain, fat, and cattle in the U.S. Last month, Mr. Trump alleged on social media that foreign-owned meatpackers were colluding to manipulate U.S. beef prices without providing details. During his first administration, the Justice Department opened an investigation into the beef industry that continued into the Biden administration. That probe recently ended, but a new one has begun into potentially anti-competitive behavior, according to the Wall Street Journal. Responding to Mr. Trump's social media post, an industry group said in a statement that beef packers have been operating at a loss for the past year due to tight cattle supply. UF beef producers welcome a fact-based discussion about beef affordability and how to best meet the needs of Americans' consumers, who are the industry's most important stakeholders, Meat Institute President and CEO Julie Ann Potts said. Meat packers say larger economies of scale allow them to produce more animal protein cheaply and that lower consumer prices stimulate demand. Critics say consolidation hurts ranchers by reducing the number of buyers for their cattle, resulting in lower prices. So what impact have tariffs had on the ongoing price of beef issue? Relatively little, actually. In July, Mr. Trump's imposition of additional 40% tariffs on Brazilian imports led to a rally in U.S. cattle futures, since Brazil is a major beef exporter. His decision to reverse that policy last month has in turn sparked anger among farm groups. Similarly, his plan to raise the quota for Argentinian beef imports faced pushback from cattle ranchers worried about foreign competition. But Argentina's higher quota would amount to only 0.6% of U.S. beef consumption. Similarly, imports from Brazil represent only a fraction of what the U.S. imports from Canada and Mexico, which is why the screwworm outbreak in Mexico has been more consequential for U.S. beef prices. And again, this particular article was by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and a note from me that I had to judiciously edit a little bit of it out because we have run out of time. As always, I appreciate you taking some of your valuable time to listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor with me. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I will be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor for you tomorrow. Thank you for listening.